A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corn. We're talking about the evolutions of various scripts used to write Hebrew, and we have the script, which is the famous one that most people associate with Hebrew, and we've done some episodes talking about Paleo-Hebrew, which is a totally fascinating script. For a while, Hebrew was written in Paleo, and then there was a phase where both it was used for more daily context and then the block script for liturgical or literary use. In addition, for handwriting use in modern Israel today, a cursive script is used. And I have to admit, I'm completely wrong about my, during my pre-research for this episode prompt, I assumed that this was something that, like a lot of facets of modern Hebrew, was kind of cobbled together in a fairly quick manner in the, you know, when Israel was founded, because so many facets of modern Hebrew as a language were follow that pattern. Jewish immigrants arriving from literally all over the world, some speaking Arabic as their first language, some Yiddish. But to summarize, not the case at all. It's actually quite, it goes back a number of centuries, and from what I gather, also underwent its own process of sort of gradual standardization. It was used for correspondence between rabbis, and variation seen within the geography within which it was used. So Ashkenazic versus Sephardic, etc. Herman and Corn, I'd love to know a little bit more about the cursive Hebrew that we have today, used for, as I mentioned, handwriting in Israel. If you're writing, you know, a shopping list on a scrap of paper, this is what people will use. In fact, outside of you know, certain contexts, I think most people might actually have a hard time writing in the classical block letters you see used in printed materials. Let's discuss the evolution of this and how we got to the standard form that we have today and use in Israel.
Daniel sent us this one about cursive Hebrew, the handwriting script Israelis use for shopping lists and sticky notes and basically anything written by hand. He assumed it was a 20th century improvisation, something cobbled together alongside modern Hebrew itself when Israel was founded. Turns out it's much older, goes back centuries, had its own slow process of standardization across Ashkenazi and Sephardic communities. And he wants to know how we got from there to the standardized cursive kids learn in Israeli schools today.
He's right about the assumption being wrong, which I love because it's one of those things where the real story is better than the guess. The cursive Hebrew used in Israel today, people call it Ketav Yad, handwriting script. Its roots go back to at least the 13th century. We're talking Central Europe, Ashkenazi Jewish communities, rabbis writing responsa to each other. This isn't a Ben-Gurion-era invention. It's a medieval development that just kept evolving.
Before we get into the Ashkenazi side, we should probably acknowledge that the Sephardic world had its own cursive tradition too, and it's arguably even older.
And Solitreo is fascinating because it's essentially the cursive descendant of the Sephardic square script, which itself came out of the medieval Iberian Jewish world. When the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, they carried Solitreo with them into the Ottoman Empire, North Africa, the Balkans. It became the handwriting script of the Sephardic diaspora for centuries.
Solitreo looks wildly different from Ashkenazi cursive. If you put them side by side, someone who only knows modern Israeli cursive might not even recognize Solitreo as Hebrew.
Solitreo is more angular, more ornate in some ways, and it developed in a completely separate trajectory. The Ashkenazi cursive that eventually won out as the basis for modern Israeli handwriting came from a different lineage, Central and Eastern Europe, starting around the 13th or 14th century. And the key thing to understand is that both of these scripts, Solitreo and Ashkenazi cursive, weren't just random sloppy versions of the square letters. They were systematic. They had their own logic, their own evolution, their own regional variants.
We've got two parallel cursive traditions developing independently for centuries, and somehow we end up with one standardized handwriting script in modern Israel. That's the part that interests me. How does one lineage win?
It's not even that one lineage won in a dramatic sense. It's more that the Ashkenazi cursive became the basis, and then the standardization process in the early 20th century smoothed out the regional variations. But let me back up and talk about why cursive Hebrew developed at all, because that's actually the starting point for understanding any of this. Hebrew writing has always had this tension between the sacred and the everyday. The square script, what we call Ketav Ashuri, the Assyrian script, that was the script of Torah scrolls, of printed books, of anything formal or liturgical. But if you're a rabbi in 13th century Germany and you need to write a lengthy legal opinion to a colleague in another city, you're not going to carefully render every serif and crown on every letter. You're going to write faster. And when you write faster, the letters start connecting. They start simplifying. The strokes become more economical.
Like any handwriting evolution anywhere. The formal script is for monuments and books. The cursive is for getting things done.
And what's interesting about Hebrew specifically is that the formal square script is already pretty economical compared to something like Chinese characters, but it still has a lot of strokes per letter. A bet in square script has that little tail at the bottom right, the horizontal roof, the vertical right stroke. In Ashkenazi cursive, that bet becomes essentially a backward C shape with a little entry stroke. Maybe two strokes total instead of three or four.
When you're writing responsa, these long legal correspondences, those save strokes add up.
They add up enormously. Some of these rabbinic responsa were basically book length. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Adaret in 13th century Barcelona, wrote thousands of responsa. His output alone would justify developing a faster script.
The cursive emerges organically, just from the practical need to write quickly. But then it starts developing regional flavors.
Yes, and this is where it gets really interesting. By the 16th or 17th century, you can look at a handwritten Hebrew document and make an educated guess about where the writer came from. Ashkenazi cursive from Poland looked different from Ashkenazi cursive from Germany. Sephardic Solitreo from Thessaloniki looked different from Solitreo from Fez. And within the Ashkenazi world, you even had sub-variants, Lithuanian, Galician, Hungarian, each with their own little quirks.
Were these differences comparable to, say, the differences between French handwriting and German handwriting in the Latin script, where you can immediately tell the nationality?
If you look at 19th century French cursive versus 19th century German current shrift, they're visibly different even though they're both writing the Latin alphabet. Hebrew cursive had similar regional markers. The shape of the Aleph, the way the lamed looped, the angle of the nun, these were tells.
We've got this landscape of regional variation. And then something happens in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that starts pushing towards standardization.
Zionism and the revival of Hebrew as a spoken language. Because here's the thing. When Eliezer ben Yehuda and others were working to turn Hebrew from a liturgical and literary language into a daily vernacular, they had to think about every aspect of the language. Vocabulary, grammar, pronunciation, and yes, handwriting. If you're going to have schools teaching Hebrew to children, you need to decide which script they're going to learn to write.
You can't just tell kids to write in square script. That's like asking English school children to write everything in Gothic blackletter.
Square script is slow. It's designed for clarity and formality, not for taking notes. So the early Hebrew educators in Palestine, and I'm talking the period of the first Aliyah and second Aliyah, roughly the 1880s through the 1910s, they had to settle on a cursive form. And what they chose was essentially a cleaned-up version of the Ashkenazi cursive that most of them had grown up with.
Because the early Zionist educators were overwhelmingly Ashkenazi.
The first Aliyah was mostly Eastern European Jews. The second Aliyah was heavily Russian and Polish. These people came from communities where Ashkenazi cursive was the standard handwriting script. When they set up schools in places like Rishon LeZion and Zichron Yaakov, they taught the cursive they knew, Sephardic immigrants. And there were plenty, especially from Yemen and the old Yishuv in Jerusalem. They had their own traditions, but the institutional momentum was with the Ashkenazi form.
That's how a medieval Central European handwriting tradition becomes the basis for modern Israeli cursive. Not through any official decree, but through the path of least resistance.
There was eventually some official standardization. In the 1920s and 30s, as the Hebrew educational system in Mandatory Palestine became more formalized, there were committees and curriculum decisions about exactly which letter forms to teach. But the core shapes were already locked in by then. The standardization was more about ironing out the regional variations, deciding, for instance, that the Polish-styled Sedai was going to be the standard rather than the Lithuanian variant.
What were some of the specific letter forms that got contested?
The Aleph is a good example. In some Ashkenazi cursive traditions, the Aleph was written almost like a mirrored K, a vertical stroke with two diagonal strokes branching off to the left. In others, it was more like a loop with a crossbar. The version that won out in Israeli cursive is somewhere in between. It looks a bit like a printed lowercase k, but with the upper arm curving upward. The shin in modern Israeli cursive is essentially a continuous wavy line, almost like a tilde that's been stretched out, or a cursive e lying on its back. In some older Ashkenazi variants, it was more angular with distinct peaks. The standardized version smoothed it out. But here's what's really striking. The Israeli cursive shin looks nothing like the square script shin. If you didn't know the mapping, you'd never guess they were the same letter.
That's true of a lot of the letters, actually. The cursive aleph bears almost no visual relationship to the square aleph. The cursive tet looks like an upside-down U. The cursive sadi looks like a number 3.
This is a sign of organic evolution. These letter forms didn't come from someone sitting down and designing a cursive version of the square letters. They came from generations of people writing fast and the shapes gradually drifting. The same thing happened with the Latin alphabet. Our lowercase a looks nothing like the capital A, and the lowercase g in most typefaces is a completely different shape from the capital G. Handwriting evolution is not a design process. It's a drift process.
By the mid-20th century, Israeli schoolchildren are all learning the same cursive forms. But I'm curious about what happened to Solitreo. Did it just die out?
Solitreo didn't die out completely, but it retreated into very specific niches. You still find it in some Sephardic communities, especially in religious contexts. Some older Sephardic Jews continued to write Solitreo for personal correspondence well into the 20th century. And there are efforts to preserve it. There are calligraphers and researchers documenting it. But, as a living daily handwriting script, it was largely replaced by the Ashkenazi-derived Israeli cursive.
Which is a kind of cultural loss, honestly. A whole visual tradition, centuries old, just fading into museums and archives.
It is a loss. And it's part of a larger pattern in the formation of Israeli culture. The Ashkenazi norms often became the default, and Sephardic and Mizrahi traditions were sidelined. The language itself is a parallel case. Modern Hebrew pronunciation is overwhelmingly based on the Sephardic vowel system. Ben Yehuda explicitly favored it, but the handwriting went the other way. Ashkenazi cursive won.
Pronunciation went Sephardic, handwriting went Ashkenazi.
Neither choice was ideologically pure. Ben Yehuda liked the Sephardic pronunciation partly because he thought it sounded more authentically Semitic, closer to Arabic, which fit the Zionist self-image of returning to the Middle East. But the Ashkenazi educators running the schools just defaulted to the cursive they knew. Nobody was going to retrain their own handwriting.
Practicality beats ideology again. Let's talk about the actual mechanics of modern Israeli cursive. If someone from, say, 19th century Poland looked at a shopping list written by an Israeli today, how much would they recognize?
A lot, actually. The letter forms have been standardized and simplified, but the core shapes are recognizably from the same family. A 19th century Polish Jew might notice that the lamed is a bit taller and loopier than what they're used to, or that the final mem has a slightly different closure, but they'd be able to read it without much trouble. The continuity is real.
Going the other direction, can a modern Israeli read a 19th century Ashkenazi handwritten letter?
It depends on the handwriting. Some 19th century cursive is quite legible to a modern Israeli. Some is much harder, especially if it's from a regional variant that had more divergent forms. And if you go back to the 18th or 17th century, it gets progressively more difficult. The letters were more elaborate, more connected, and some of the shapes hadn't yet evolved into their modern forms.
There's a readability gradient over time, just like with English handwriting. A modern English speaker can read a letter from the 1920s pretty easily, but a letter from the 1700s requires some effort.
And the further back you go, the more you're dealing with what are essentially different scripts that happen to share a common ancestor. By the time you get to the earliest Ashkenazi cursive documents from the 13th or 14th century, you're looking at something that a modern Israeli would struggle with considerably.
One thing I've noticed, having lived in Israel, is that a lot of people actually have trouble writing in square script. If you ask an average Israeli to write something in the block letters you see in a printed book, they'll hesitate. They might make mistakes. The cursive is so dominant as the handwriting form that the square script has become almost exclusively a reading script.
This is a really important point. In most alphabetic cultures, children learn to read and write the same letter forms. In Israel, there's a genuine digraphia, two related but visually distinct scripts used in different contexts. Children learn to read square script first, then separately learn to write in cursive. And for many Israelis, writing in square script feels unnatural and clumsy because they simply never practice it.
It's like if English-speaking children learn to read in Times New Roman, but learn to write exclusively in a cursive that looks nothing like it. Which, to be fair, was somewhat true in the era when English cursive was heavily emphasized.
Right, but even English cursive shares more visual DNA with printed letters than Hebrew cursive does with square script. The Hebrew case is more extreme. Some of the mappings are almost arbitrary. You just have to memorize that this squiggle equals that square letter.
Which raises an interesting question. Does this digraphia have cognitive effects? Does it make learning to read and write Hebrew harder or easier?
There's actually some research on this. The evidence is mixed. Some studies suggest that digraphia adds a cognitive load. You're essentially learning two visual systems for the same underlying alphabet. But other research suggests it might actually help with letter recognition, because the brain has to learn the abstract letter identity separate from the specific visual form. If you only ever see an aleph in one shape, you might not fully internalize what makes an aleph.
The extra difficulty might produce deeper learning. That's a very Jewish pedagogical outcome.
Suffering leads to wisdom. Korn, it's in the contract.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the Sephardic cursive traditions. What did it actually look like, and how different was it from the Ashkenazi cursive?
Solitreo is striking. It's more vertical than Ashkenazi cursive, with taller, narrower letters. The strokes tend to be thinner and more angular. Some of the letter forms are completely different. The Solitreo Aleph looks almost like a printed lowercase h with an extra crossbar, whereas the Ashkenazi Aleph looks like a K. The Solitreo Shin looks like a zigzag or a series of connected V shapes. It's genuinely a different script.
Solitreo was used for Ladino, right? So it wasn't just writing Hebrew, it was also the script for Judeo-Spanish.
Yes, and this is a crucial distinction. Solitreo was the handwriting script for both Hebrew and Ladino in the Sephardic world, just as Ashkenazi cursive was used for both Hebrew and Yiddish in the Ashkenazi world. But the base languages were different, and the scripts served different literary cultures. Ladino literature, newspapers, novels, translations, was often printed in square script, but handwritten Ladino was in Solitreo.
Solitreo was doing double duty. Handwriting for sacred Hebrew texts and for everyday Ladino correspondence.
And that's part of why it survived as long as it did. It had a functional role in a living language community. When Ladino started declining as a daily language in the 20th century, Solitreo lost one of its main use cases. The Holocaust also devastated the Sephardic communities of the Balkans, particularly in Salonika, which had been a major center of Ladino culture. Between linguistic shift and demographic catastrophe, Solitreo's user base shrank dramatically.
The Ashkenazi cursive didn't face the same pressures because Yiddish was declining too, but the Ashkenazi cursive had already been adopted as the basis for Israeli Hebrew handwriting.
The Ashkenazi cursive got institutionalized just as its original Yiddish language ecosystem was weakening. Solitreo never got that institutional foothold in the Zionist education system.
Let's talk about the actual standardization process in more detail. You mentioned committees in the 1920s and 30s. Who was making these decisions, and what were the debates like?
The main institutional player was the Va'ad HaLashon, the Hebrew Language Committee, which was the predecessor to the modern Academy of the Hebrew Language. The Va'ad HaLashon was founded by Ben Yehuda in 1890 and was focused primarily on vocabulary and grammar. But as the Hebrew school system expanded in Mandatory Palestine, questions of writing instruction inevitably came up. Teachers needed guidance on which cursive forms to teach.
Were there actual published standards, like a handwriting manual?
In the 1920s, several Hebrew handwriting manuals were published in Palestine, showing model letter forms for teachers to use. These weren't legally binding. There was no Ministry of Education at that point, but they were widely adopted because teachers wanted consistency. The most influential was probably a guide published by the Hebrew Teachers Federation around 1924, which laid out a set of cursive letter forms that look very close to what Israeli children learn today.
By the 1920s, the basic shapes are already locked in. 100 years later, kids are learning essentially the same forms,
with some minor modifications. The lamed has gotten a bit taller over the decades. The final pay has simplified slightly. But yes, a time-traveling schoolchild from 1925, Tel Aviv could sit in a first-grade classroom today and follow along pretty well.
That's actually remarkable stability for a script that was, at that point, still quite young in its standardized form.
It speaks to the power of institutionalization through schools. Once you teach a million children to write a certain way, that becomes the standard, and it's very hard to change. Handwriting is one of the most conservative things humans do. It gets locked in during childhood and persists for life.
Unless you're a doctor, apparently, then all bets are off.
Hebrew doctor handwriting is its own separate script, completely illegible, possibly cryptographic. There are probably medieval Kabbalists who would struggle with an Israeli prescription.
We've covered the Ashkenazi origins, the Sephardic alternative, the standardization in mandatory Palestine. What about the actual visual logic of the script? How does it relate to the square letters? Is there any systematic pattern to how the cursive forms evolved?
There are some patterns, but they're not perfectly consistent. One common transformation is that the square script's horizontal and vertical strokes get connected by curves. In square script, a dalet is a horizontal roof and a vertical right leg, two strokes meeting at a right angle. In cursive, those two strokes get joined by a curve, and the whole letter becomes a sort of backward C shape with a flat top.
Like the difference between printed capital E and cursive lowercase e in English.
Another pattern is that letters that require lifting the pen in square script get turned into continuous strokes in cursive. The square script mem has multiple strokes. In cursive, it's written in one continuous motion. The same with the bet, the kaf, the pe.
Then there are letters where the cursive form seems to come from a completely different planet.
The sadi in Israeli cursive looks like a number 3. In square script, it looks like a bent L with a little hook. The connection between these two shapes is not obvious at all. What happened historically is that the right leg of the sadi gradually curved inward and upward over centuries, while the left leg shortened and eventually merged with the body of the letter. By the time the process was done, the original square shape was unrecognizable.
It's like watching a species evolve. The intermediate forms make sense, but the starting point and the ending point look unrelated.
Without the fossil record, the intermediate manuscripts, you'd never guess the lineage. This is why paleography, the study of historical handwriting, is so important. Without it, you'd look at a modern Israeli cursive sadi and a square script sadi and assume they were different letters that happened to share a name.
Is there a good reference work on this? Something that traces the evolution of each letter?
The classic work is by Solomon Birnbaum. He wrote extensively on Hebrew paleography, and his book, The Hebrew Scripts, from the 1950s, is still a foundational text. It's basically a visual atlas of Hebrew letter forms across time and geography, with plates showing the evolution of each letter. If you want to see the intermediate forms of the tzadi, Birnbaum has them.
I'll have to track that down.
It's the kind of book where you open it and 3 hours disappear. Every page is just letter form after letter form, manuscript after manuscript. For a certain kind of person, it's pure catnip.
For you, you mean?
I'm not denying it.
Let's shift gears slightly. We've been talking about the Ashkenazi cursive and its journey to becoming the Israeli standard, but I'm curious about the actual experience of writing in Hebrew cursive versus, say, English cursive. Are there ergonomic differences? Is one faster?
Hebrew cursive is generally faster to write than English cursive, for a couple of reasons. First, Hebrew letters tend to be simpler, fewer strokes per letter on average. Second, Hebrew is written right to left, which for right-handed people means you're pulling the pen rather than pushing it. Pushing creates more friction and fatigue. Pulling is smoother and faster.
That's a mechanical advantage I'd never considered.
It's subtle, but real. Left-handed people have the opposite experience. English is easier for them because they're pulling, and Hebrew is harder because they're pushing. Which is probably why left-handed Israelis often develop very distinctive handwriting with a forward slant that's the opposite of what right-handed writers produce.
Of course, in the pre-ballpoint era, when everyone used fountain pens or quills, the right-to-left advantage would have been even more pronounced. Pushing a fountain pen creates all kinds of problems with ink flow and nib catching.
The right-to-left direction of Hebrew script probably evolved partly because of this. If you're carving in stone, direction doesn't matter much, but once you're writing with ink on parchment or paper, pulling is better. And most people are right-handed.
The script direction and the cursive simplification are both, at root, ergonomic optimizations.
Writing systems evolve toward efficiency. The forms that survive are the ones that let people write faster with less fatigue. It's not a conscious design process. It's just that over generations, the easier forms went out because people naturally gravitate toward them.
Which brings us back to the standardization question in a different way. Once you have a standardized cursive taught in schools, does the evolution stop, or does it keep changing, just more slowly?
It keeps changing, but the rate slows down dramatically. Standardization through schooling acts like a brake on evolution. When every child is taught the same letter forms and graded on reproducing them correctly, the range of variation narrows, but it doesn't disappear entirely. If you look at Israeli handwriting today, you'll see a lot of individual variation. Some people write a very round cursive, some write an angular one, some connect letters in ways the textbooks don't teach.
There are probably generational shifts too. The handwriting of someone who learned in the 1950s might look different from someone who learned in the 2000s.
There's been a noticeable trend towards simplification. The lamed, for instance, has gotten taller and loopier in recent decades, almost a fashion thing. And some of the more elaborate connecting strokes that were taught in the mid-20th century have been dropped. The modern Israeli cursive is cleaner, more minimal, than what you'd see in a 1950s school notebook.
I wonder if digital communication is changing things too. When you mostly type in Hebrew, does your handwriting get worse or just different?
It's a real phenomenon. People who grew up typing on phones and computers often have less fluent handwriting, in any script. But with Hebrew specifically, there's an interesting twist, which is that Hebrew typing on a standard keyboard requires you to know the square script letter positions. So in a weird way, typing might be reinforcing familiarity with the square letters even as it reduces handwriting practice.
The square script is getting reinforced through technology while the cursive is getting less practice. That could shift the digraphia balance over time.
I don't think cursive Hebrew is going to disappear. It's too deeply embedded in the education system. But I do think we might see a generation that's more comfortable reading and typing square script than writing cursive, which would be a historical reversal.
The pendulum swinging back after centuries of cursive dominance in handwriting.
If that happens, future paleographers will have a field day studying the digital transition, the way we now study the transition from scroll to codex.
All right. Before we wrap up, I want to circle back to something Daniel mentioned in the prompt. This idea that most Israelis would have a hard time writing in square script. I think that's worth unpacking a bit more, because it tells us something about what handwriting actually is. Handwriting isn't just a way of putting letters on a page. It's a motor skill, a set of deeply ingrained movement patterns. When you learn to write in cursive, you're training your hand to make specific shapes in specific sequences. The square script uses different shapes and different stroke orders. So asking someone to write in square script is like asking them to write with their non-dominant hand. The motor programs just aren't there.
And it's why you'll see adult Israelis, perfectly literate people, struggling to write a sign in square letters. They'll produce something that looks like a child's printing. Wobbly, uncertain, with inconsistent letter sizes. It's not that they don't know what the letters look like, it's that their hands don't know how to make them.
This is also why calligraphy is a separate skill. A sofa, a Torah scribe, spends years training to produce perfect square letters. It's not just knowing the shapes, it's building the muscle memory, the breathing patterns, the rhythm. The fact that square script requires that kind of specialized training is part of what makes it sacred.
There's a beautiful symmetry there. The square script is the script of the sacred, and it requires sacred discipline to produce. The cursive is the script of the everyday, and it evolves through the casual, undisciplined movements of people just trying to get words onto paper. Each script is perfectly suited to its domain.
The medium is the message, once again.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, researchers in the Aleutian Islands discovered that Pacific sleeper sharks were using their electroreception to track and hunt stellar sea lions, effectively turning the sea lions' own navigational bioelectric fields into a homing beacon. The sharks can detect the sea lions' muscle activity from over a mile away.
The sea lions are broadcasting their location just by moving their muscles.
Every twitch is a flare in the dark. That is deeply unsettling. Thank you, Hilbert. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.